May it please the court, counsel for the board. I'm Quint McTeer, and I'm counsel for the appellants, Dan and Mary Helcher and Cincinnati Bell Wireless, LLC. For convenience, likely throughout my argument, I'll refer to the appellants collectively as CBW or Cincinnati Bell Wireless. As this court is well aware, this is a case which involves a cell tower. In this case, Cincinnati Bell Wireless proposed and intended to construct and operate a cell tower on the Helcher's property located in Dearborn County, Indiana.
Mr. How do you pronounce your last name?
McTeer.
McTeer, okay. Before you get into the merits of your argument, I wanted to alert you to the fact that I'm a little concerned about the way the district court handled counts 5 through 9, because looking at the party's stipulation, this was done without prejudice and with the idea that they would be renewed should the case wind up going back to the district court, and that makes it look like a non-final judgment to me.
Well, Your Honor, let's see. Just the procedural posture was we bifurcated the case so that we would consider claims 1 through 4, which were the Telecom Act claims.
Mm-hmm.
We do have a separate letter agreement, which is not reflected in the record, that if this case is affirmed at this court, that those claims will then be final. I mean, as a practical matter, Your Honor, if we lose this appeal, those claims have no value in any event. But we didn't want to... We thought it was a waste of judicial economy for purposes to litigate those claims after we had the ruling on the first 4 claims.
Well, the only problem with that is that this court has a number of cases in which we say you don't have a final judgment, which of course means that you've resolved all claims, all parties, and if part of it is dismissed with prejudice. Now, in one of these cases, JTC Petroleum against Piazza Motor Fuels, actually, that problem was solved by the parties at this court being willing to stipulate that the dismissal of the other claims was with prejudice. But I wanted to alert you to this issue. And Judge Flom, did you?
Yeah, perhaps we could best handle this by having the parties submit simultaneous supplemental brief on this point in 14 days.
I'm sorry, simultaneous brief.
On the jurisdictional issue, the point
just raised by Judge Wood.
Judge Wood, and I guess you're suggesting one way to cure that might be an agreement to dismiss.
Correct. In our cases, if the parties are willing to say that, in this instance, counts 5 through 9 are gone with prejudice, that solves the problem. At that point, everything's over with. If you're going to try to do something fancier and try to say, well, maybe it was 54B or maybe it was something else, there's some real briefing that would
right.
need to take
well,
place.
Your Honor, I guess this was my issue in that I was unwilling to dismiss the claims. I didn't want to be a perception there had been a ruling on the merit of those claims, so they were dismissed with prejudice, which to me made them final and appealable for purposes.
Well, without prejudice is how they were dismissed.
I'm sorry, without prejudice.
But you don't have to decide right this second if you don't want, I mean, if you want to take advantage of the time.
I think I would prefer that, Your Honor. Obviously, I haven't had time to discuss this with my client. I was not aware that this was a problem or potential issue for the court. So it sounds like the decision is supplemental briefs on the jurisdictional issue, and one potential way to cure that might be an agreement between the parties that we would convert those dismissals to with prejudice. And just to be clear, Your Honor, if the parties were to reach such an agreement, would that obviate the need, in your mind, to have briefs on the issue?
I believe so, yes. If you look at this decision, it's JTC Petroleum against Piazza Motor Fuels at 190 F3rd 775. I think that will show you where this comes from.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. And I apologize for not having appreciated fully that issue for purposes of this argument today. But I think what, as I understand where we are today, if we're willing to dismiss them with prejudice, that will solve the problem from the
right.
court standpoint. If we're unwilling to do so, then we need to submit supplemental briefs within
That's
14
right.
days. Hopefully, we can probably do the first suggestion after I've had time to consult with my client and obviously consult with Mr. Lowe. Again, just start from the beginning. Again, this case, as we know, is about a cell tower. And this case was a Cincinnati Bell Wireless was intending to construct and operate a cell tower on the Helchers property. And as required by the board's ordinances, Cincinnati Bell Wireless, CBW, was required to meet with the board's experts in a pre-application meeting, which occurred actually over 4 years ago from today.
You know, I was wondering, are you arguing that there are no requirements under Article 3 that aren't already covered by Article 15, or are you claiming that Article 3 is simply not relevant to the placement of wireless towers?
Would be the first, Your Honor. Essentially, our claim is that once you've gone through the whole requirements of Article 15, there's nothing left for the board to review in Article 3. That the conditional use permit, I think it's actually suggested in Article 15, if you've met Article 15, if the board's ordinances require you to go someplace else, whether it's Article 3 for a conditional use permit, it seems to suggest that if you've met Article 15, your application should be approved.
So, in other words, are you saying that once the board's hired experts have recommended approval, there's nothing left for the board to do other than rubber stamp the application?
Well, Your Honor, no, I'm not suggesting that. But what I am suggesting, absent some additional proof in the record, which we do not have in this case, there's nothing to contradict the finding by the board. In some of the court's cases that have considered the act in the past, for example, I believe in the Argiter case, there had been an initial proceeding at the district court, was remanded back to the board for another hearing. I think in the VoiceStream case, for example, there had been an initial hearing at the board level. They wanted additional proof on some issues, so they, I think, at that point obtained a consultant to review the application. There was, at that point, give and take between the consultant. So if the board was not satisfied with the state of the record at that time and felt that there were questions that had not been answered, they needed to consult with the board's experts, which they did not do, to determine what was missing and could have, although I'm sure my client would not have been particularly happy, but they could have continued the hearing to make sure that their concerns were satisfied. But the state of the record as we have it now, there is no evidence that contradicts the findings of the board's experts on the issue of the visual impact of the facility or the availability of alternate locations.
I don't know how you can say that, though. I mean, because I had the same rubber stamp concern that Judge Rovner has just raised, and there was quite a bit of testimony about where this tower was proposed to be located and how close it was to residential neighborhoods. And in these zoning hearings, it's not like the board is the Food and Drug Administration or something. This is a zoning procedure that Congress left in the hands of local authorities, and it seems the board did have evidence before it about visual impact.
Well, if I might respond, Your Honor.
Sure.
Your Honor, the visual impact, all we have of the visual impact is some photo simulations prepared by the adjoining landowner, which I would say are of somewhat uncertain creation, which essentially I think the testimony was she took a picture of another tower, never identified where the tower was, claims it was of similar construction, I believe, as to whether it was the size, superimposed it onto a picture of the area where the tower would be. For example, some of the pictures, the tower shows in the foreground in front of trees and other foliage. That's really the only evidence we have in the record of any visual impact of the tower.
But what else can you do before the tower is built? And actually, while you're answering that, another part of your argument that I think gives me some concern is the standard that you implicitly seem to be arguing for expert testimony. Because certainly, Daubert and Rule 702 are not binding on local zoning authorities, are they?
No, and I'm not suggesting that. But I think really all we have in this case is the pictures from the adjoining landowner. The exercise that the board did not, one, they did ask the consultant, they said, did you look at visual impact? The expert said at the hearing on March 14th, yes, we looked at visual impact, and this is the least visually intrusive application that they can in this case.
On that piece of property?
I don't believe that the record is so limited. I don't think that that's essentially what the board's experts were saying. And if there's any dispute in the record, it's incumbent on the board. I mean, in the other cases that have been before this court, if the board had questions or concerns, and that question and the subsequent question were the only two inquiries to the board's experts throughout the remainder of the hearing. So the next inquiry was, how did they prove the need for the facility? And the board's experts said, through a propagation map, which was then reviewed and approved by us as the experts. So what I am suggesting is that if the board had any doubt that there was not adequate proof from their experts, again, these are not experts retained by Cincinnati Bell Wireless. These are experts retained by the board. And then I know some of the cases express some concern that, gee, landowners cannot be, it's hard for them to marshal the proof necessary to rebut experts retained by the carrier, but we don't have that situation here. So what I am suggesting is there has to be proof in the record that there's a viable alternate location. And not only is there no proof on that issue in the record, all the proof contradicts that. All the proof suggests that, in fact, this is the least visually intrusive location, that Cincinnati Bell Wireless cannot get adequate coverage from any other location in the area.
But you're acting as though it's the board's burden to come forward with that, and I don't think it is.
Well,
you had to show that you met
and we
the
did
statutory
show, Your Honor.
Requirement. Well, that's
where
what we're
in
here
the
for.
Record. Where in the record would we find evidence that was submitted to the board by Cincinnati Bell that it had considered all other locations rather than just all co-location sites? In other words, the board mentions other hilltops available that aren't visible from residential areas. Is there evidence that these hilltops were considered and excluded for a legitimate reason?
Well, Your Honor, I would point to specifically there's in our separate appendix 7 and separate appendix 9, there are maps that were provided by Cincinnati Bell Wireless that go to, now, those maps in particular deal primarily with the co-location opportunities, but,
right.
But those maps, and again, a point that I would like to make for this court, that the board is not qualified and neither is the district court qualified to review those maps to determine exactly what they show. That's the purpose of hiring the expert. The experts reviewed those maps to determine not only that the co-location wasn't appropriate, but that based on the propagation maps and other signal strength maps and radio frequency data, that other locations would not be a viable alternative for Cincinnati Bell Wireless to provide adequate coverage for its network.
But here's another question that concerns me about your theory, and I know I'm jumping ahead to the no alternative question. The statute looks at whether a particular decision would have the effect of prohibiting personal wireless service, but it doesn't say that every single company that comes along has to have the same kind of service. That would be really quite a different standard. And I don't know where in this record we have any evidence about whether, you know, other carriers were providing service in this particular area. Because, you know, you see the distinction I'm drawing between one company being
correct
able to give you a decent signal.
Well, and that really goes, I guess, primarily more to, we brought four Telecom Act claims, the written decision,
right,
the substantial evidence, the discrimination, and the prohibition of service. I think the issue you're raising.
I'm raising a prohibition of service issue, but I just don't see the evidence where anything but Cincinnati Bell Wireless may be disadvantaged by this decision.
Your Honor, and I think that's a fair comment, that they're proof in the record, but the proof was not required by the board's ordinance. So it seems unfair.
It's required by the statute. You have to show that the board is wrong for a statutory reason. I guess that's where
the
burden is.
Well, Your Honor, I would look to the Primco case. In the Primco case, this court said that the failure of proof on the alternate location issue, the failure of proof of other carriers providing service in the area, the failure of proof of the height of other towers was not fatal to the carrier there, but it was fatal to the agency. That meant the agency did not have substantial evidence to support its decision.
I don't think Primco goes that far. I don't think that, you know, there were other points in PrimeCo, but if you're just focusing on the prohibition aspect of things and the local zoning authority says we don't want you to build a tower on the Helcher property, we don't assume that that decision means that there is effectively no other way to provide wireless service.
Well, may I read briefly?
Sure,
from
go ahead.
There's a portion in the PrimeCo case, and I believe Judge Robner, you were on that panel, but reading from, there's an issue, the discussion in the PrimeCo case about the level of quality of service, and the court says, we do not know how many potential customers for such service there are in the area, nor how many other providers of cellular phone service or service serve them, and with what quality of service and at what price. For all we know, the impact of the denial and the permit sought by Verizon would be negligible. So to me, that says the failure of proof on that issue wasn't fatal to Verizon as the carrier in that case. It was fatal to the board as a failure to have substantial evidence to demonstrate that there was support for the decision on the issue of whether the level of service in the area.
What other wireless carriers were treated more favorably than than you were? I mean, how do you show discrimination without naming carriers who were treated better?
Well, and again, we did cite authority in our brief for the proposition that unfair treatment to the carrier is sufficient to establish a discrimination claim.
Without reference to anyone else?
That's what the authorities we cited in our brief suggest, yes.
Well, that is a little unusual.
Well, Your Honor, actually today, and I see that I've already gone into my rebuttal time, actually the what I intended to focus on today was actually the written decision and the substantial evidence claims of, as a practical matter, although I believe in the prohibition of service and discrimination claims, I think it's unlikely that this court would independently find in my favor on those two claims and not find in my favor on the substantial evidence. So, on the written decision issue, I would just submit to this court that the writing by the board is not a separate writing. And we've asked, as the court is well aware, to adopt the standard enunciated by the Sixth Circuit in the new PAR, which is finds from or relies on the First Circuit decision in the Southwestern Bell case versus Todd.
But, of course, there are different approaches among the circuits on this point. And it seems to me this is actually quite analogous to what this court, at least, has in our own internal circuit rules, where we require district judges to give reasons when dismissing a claim. And it's okay if it's either in a separate written memorandum or if it's on the record, meaning to say that there's a transcript of the thing. I don't see anything in the Telecommunications Act prescribing such detailed rules of procedure for zoning boards.
Well, but Your Honor, I think is you authored the VoiceStream case, if I'm correct. And in that case, in a footnote, the court looked at it was the Agutter case.
It was Agutter.
And I think you were on the panel in the VoiceStream case. But in the VoiceStream case, in a footnote, it looked at the competing circuit rules on this issue, and it looked as to the court that it determined had a narrower standard. It looked to the Fourth Circuit, but I believe in the Fourth Circuit case cited in VoiceStream, the AT&T Wireless versus Virginia Beach, that court required a writing separate from the written record, and it seems to me that is supported by the language from the Act.
Isn't that a lot of pointless requirements, though? If we can tell from the written record, as opposed to oral statements, as opposed to going out and taking depositions of people from the board, if we can tell from the written record what the decisions were, then we have something we can review. On the other hand, if all we have is the word denied and there isn't any explanation, that would not be enough for appellate review. So why not a pragmatic approach?
Well, but Your Honor, I think the statute speaks to the idea that it should have a separate writing separate from the written record.
And statute doesn't say separate writing.
It says it uses the word and between the written and the Todd case thought there was a distinction between a written decision and a written record. So, but the problem you have in this case is then you have individual statements from the members of the board that don't make their way. Like, for example, in the case here, the only thing listed in the motion was the failure of the CBW to adequately investigate other hilltops. The only other thing that was really mentioned in the discussion by the board was the visual impact. And I see now I'm in my...
I only can conclude that thought in light of our exchange on the
supplemental
briefing. You'll get an extra 2 minutes for rebuttal.
I'm sorry. I apologize.
No. It's not your fault.
And I'm sorry. But I think the point made by the courts in Todd and New Parr is that if we look at, like in this case, we have a record that has comments back and forth. The only thing that made its way into the motion was the failure to have adequately investigated hilltops or other locations. So it didn't make its way into the motion about the visual impact. That's only one statement by the board. Do we take that statement as the gospel of the board? And that's why we advocate in advance the requirements of the Sixth Circuit and the New Parr and the Southwest Bell that we believe are supported by the Act, that you have a separate writing with reasons sufficiently detailed to allow judicial review. So you avoid the problem found by those courts that is the single statement of a board member, the speaking of the board or not. Thank you. I appreciate it. And I'm sorry.
I'm because of the exchange we had on the question of the other counts, I will give you 2 more minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you very much, and I will. If you have any questions, I'll try to address them at that time.
Thank you, Mr. McDear.
Thank you.
Mr. Lowe?
Your Honors, may it please the Court, counsel for the appellants. We are here today asking that you affirm the district court's ruling that this decision by the Dearborn County Board of Zoning Appeals did not violate the Telecommunications Act. The appellant has made several allegations against us that it violated the Telecom Act for several different reasons, four different reasons. One, that it was in writing or was not in writing. One, that it was not supported by substantial evidence. One, because it effectively prohibits wireless service. And four, because it unreasonably discriminates against his client or the appellant. Your Honors, none of these grounds are sufficient to justify the reversal of the district court.
Maybe we should begin, though, with the point where Mr. McTeer ended and think about this writing requirement, because he makes the point that this would be true if you're looking at a discussion in Congress or anything else, that there isn't any place where the board really pulls it all together and says, now we've heard all of the evidence, we've read our expert reports, we've listened to the various people who testified, this is what we glean from it, and this is why we're taking the action. We don't really see that, do we?
Well, I would disagree with that, Your Honor, because I do think that the plaintiff's main argument is, or one of them, their arguments, is that they don't know why the board made the decision it made. I think it was very clear from the evidence that was presented to the board, as well as the motion that was made by the board. The motion was made was very specific. It was specific in stating that Article 315B and Article 315D were reasons why it was denied, and Article 1514 was why it was denied, and set out those reasons.
But the board minutes, as you just note, do list the provisions under which the application was denied. But there are no factual findings to speak of. In other words, how do we go about reviewing a board's decision if we don't know the facts on which the board has based its decision?
Your Honor, I would refer this court to the Fourth Circuit's approach in AT&T versus Virginia Beach, because in that case, what it did is looked at congressional intent as well as what the Congress meant when it said in writing. It said to import anything requiring factual findings or things more significant than a writing would be importing more into the Act than what's required. The substantial evidence portion of the Act is what you look at to determine whether there was substantial evidence to support the board's decision. the in-writing requirement is just that the document be in writing. Congress had, in several other instances in the Telecommunications Act, required boards or parties to properly make their decisions based on findings of fact, specifically 47 U.S.C. 252 E1 and 47 U.S.C. 271 D3 were instances cited by the AT&T versus Virginia Beach Court that said if the court was if Congress intended to require a board to institute formal findings of fact or have formal findings of fact or conclusions of law, that they would have done so. I would also point to the court's decision or the district court's decision in Primeco versus Fox Lake Village, which refers to the fact that you're dealing with lay people. You're dealing with board members who are not learned in the issues of law or what's sufficient.
Was the board counseled? I mean, did they have counsel for the board?
They did have counsel for the board that was present.
And
yes.
Was counsel responsible for the drafting of the minutes?
No, Your Honor. That that is done by the minute taker as well as the planning commission, the officer of the planning commission drafts the minutes. So I would say that the requirement of factual findings in a decision by the board is not necessary just by the in-writing requirement. What you look at is the substantial evidence portion of the statute, which is what AT&T Virginia Beach versus Virginia Beach from the Fourth Circuit said, and you determine whether there was substantial evidence. Because to import a factual finding requirement or a conclusion of law requirement into the in-writing requirement solely would do more than Congress intended to do with the Act.
So essentially you're arguing that all we need to have is the bottom line. I think that's the approach the Fourth Circuit took, actually. Bottom line, denied, and then we just look through the record to see if there's anything in there that would support such a finding?
I would agree, Your Honor. I think that's what the Fourth Circuit said, and I think that's the approach that should be followed, because to do more would frustrate congressional intent, and it would also require more than what's required in the Act. Congress means what it says and intends what it means. Congress didn't put anything in the Act that says factual findings are required in the writing. So in the absence of that, it is only left to interpretation that they did not mean that the writing required factual findings.
But this, I was just going to say, but the statute as a whole represents a balance between local control on the one side and the need to make sure that there's an effective national network of, among other things, wireless communication. And it seems to me quite possible you could look at that in writing requirement not as just a mere formality that you need to write the word denied down somewhere, but as, in a sense, as a meaningful writing requirement.
Well, again, Your Honor, I would counsel this court to look at the Fourth Circuit's opinion in AT&T versus Virginia Beach, because it says there that that's what the substantial evidence requirement is for, that determining whether there were sufficient findings, sufficient conclusions upon which the board made its decision is not something that should be required by writing. It's something that should be determined by the substantial evidence standard created by the court or created by the Congress in the Act.
Well, Mr. Lowe,
yeah.
Go ahead.
Okay, thank you. There are some types of zoning where a conditional use permit would not be required, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
If Cincinnati Bell wanted to place this tower on property that did not require a conditional use permit, would the board be obliged to accept the recommendation of the hired experts?
Your Honor, I think specifically if we look at, I think it's Article 1508 of the zoning ordinance, it talks about a principally permitted use, and they have to obtain a permit. So, again, the permit, although a permitted use, still requires a permit. And 1508 says that even if you are in one where a conditional use is not required, you still have to go before the board and meet the obligations, I believe, of Section 23 of the zoning ordinance regarding those types of uses. So I don't think either way it's a rubber stamp that the consultant says that you get the tower, you get the tower. I think you still have to meet the requirements of the use in question.
Is the board required to use these consultants?
No. According to Article 1530 of the zoning ordinance, it says that the board may employ consultants to assist it in reviewing the application. So, no, they are not required.
The plaintiffs have claimed that the record demonstrates that there's no property within Cincinnati Bell's search ring that it is not zoned agricultural. Does the board dispute that claim?
No, Your Honor. I think all the property in the area that Cincinnati Bell Wireless has determined is their search ring is agricultural.
If all the relevant land is zoned agricultural, does an applicant really need to present evidence about the 7 land categories that are preferred to agricultural land? I mean, doesn't that seem like a useless waste of time, effort, money?
In our opinion, Your Honor, no, it does not. The reason it does not is because just because Cincinnati Bell Wireless has determined a search ring does not determine that there might not be other properties and other areas outside that search ring that may provide the same coverage that they require. So, no, it is not, in our opinion, it is not a useless procedure. Additionally, Article 1514 talks about even if you're in the certain zoning area, you have to determine, and the district court found at the lower level, that you have to determine that this site is the most appropriate. For the tower based on the zoning requirements.
So is there other agricultural land within that area that's further from the residential section?
Your Honor, there are several instances from remonstrators who testify that they believe there are additional hilltops in that area that might provide the same type of coverage but not near residential areas. That's the most in the record regarding an answer to your question.
Well, Mr. Lowe, you wouldn't question the proposition that judicial review would be enhanced by separate writings, would you?
Well, I understand the court's position. I don't necessarily disagree with it, but that's not the requirement. That's not why Congress enacted this requirement. Congress enacted the substantial evidence requirement to allow
for judicial review. So you think that Congress had in mind that minutes are sufficient?
I do, Your Honor.
Whatever the record is.
Well, I do, because it talks about substantial evidence in a written record. That's what the statute specifically says. And if you can determine, if a reviewing court can determine from substantial evidence in the written record the reason for the denial, which according to most of the cases that have been cited in this case, courts can look at evidence outside the record
to determine.
Well, you
know, these cases, to me it seems, often revolve around not in my backyard, which is true of all zoning, I suspect, not just that which we look at in the Telecommunications Act. And I suspect that in all these kinds of hearings, there will be someone suggesting that it's an inappropriate location because of proximity to whatever. So without a separate writing that speaks to where the reliance was targeted, won't we always find in a case such as this, quote, substantial evidence, assuming that it's a credible person who's making the suggestion that this is an inappropriate location?
Well, Your Honor, that may be the case, because this is a situation where you're sitting in a position where your decision has to be highly deferential to the board. The board is making, and Congress intends that.
Well, all the more reason that we would like a heightened underscoring of and targeting of the kind of reasoning so that we could get to the balance that Judge Wood appropriately suggested is the aim of the act.
And again, Your Honor, I would say that is taken care of by the substantial evidence. I don't think you need written findings of fact and conclusions of law from lay people to determine what this is. The substantial evidence that's in the record is presumed to be the reason why the board, and if there is no substantial evidence in the record, then a district court or a reviewing court or this court will determine that there wasn't substantial evidence. But it's not mandated by the Act that this writing, the in-writing requirement, contain conclusions of law or findings of fact.
Well, do you think Congress had in mind that every county in the United States, no matter how small, has a county lawyer, either in the freestanding position or the county prosecutor in his civil capacity? Do you think Congress had that in mind as an aid to representing the boards?
The reason I keep saying that, Your Honor, is several courts that have reviewed Telecom Act cases all talk about that and discuss the fact that we're dealing with lay people. We're not dealing with people who are knowledgeable about the law, able to know what sufficient findings of fact are. And that's why they restrict or have gone, there have been middle ground approaches, that there have been approaches such as NUPAR, which we think goes too far, approaches such as Virginia Beach, which says the writing is that. These courts have said that Congress did not intend that. So that's why.
I wanted to turn for a minute to what did count as the substantial evidence that you're relying on. And I wanted particularly your comments on Mr. Elliott and Mr. Dale, because Mr. Elliott's testimony, to start with his, is awfully vague, right? He just says, oh, you know, if this tower's built, I think values will go down. He doesn't say by how much. He doesn't say much of anything, does he?
And I agree, but I would draw you back to your question that you had to Mr. McTeer with regard to qualification of an expert in a Board of Zoning Appeals hearing. This isn't a Daubert hearing. This isn't a situation. And I understand the court's concern. It was the concern expressed by the district court at the lower court level that Mr. Elliott is not appropriately qualified.
Well, and he may be wonderfully qualified, but he wasn't saying things that are terribly useful. And I would analogize in my own mind to what happens at sentencing hearings in the federal courts, where once again the formal rules of evidence don't apply. You can bring in hearsay, you can bring in things, but there is a fundamental underlying rule that says whatever's in there needs to be reliable, it needs to be helpful. And I'm really not sure, even though Mr. Elliott may be a very experienced real estate appraiser, that if you just say, gee, I think if this tower's built, it's going to hurt property values, is that really helpful?
Well, I can understand the court's concern, but Mr. Elliott also testified about other things as well, and not necessarily monetary values of what impact the tower would have, but also aesthetic values. And as a real estate appraiser, he would certainly have the ability to know what affects property value, whether it's a certain amount or whether it's how it would affect the sale of a property.
But wouldn't you think that if Mr. Elliott had quantified his testimony and said, I think if this tower is built, it's going to have a 2% downward effect on property values, that would be a case where maybe the board is acting inappropriately to deny the conditional use permit. Whereas if he said, I think it'll cause the property values in the immediate area to plummet by 20%, that might be a situation that would be very supportive of what. In other words, isn't the magnitude of some importance?
And I can understand the court's concern, but when you look at what was presented by Cincinnati Bell Wireless on the same topic, there was absolutely nothing. There was one statement made by Mr. Carr that this would not affect property values. There's no basis for Mr. Carr to make the statement either. It's kind of a wash. It doesn't mean that there wasn't substantial evidence on other grounds. As long as there's substantial evidence on one ground to support the reason that the board made the decision it did, then that's enough. So we would say that there was substantial evidence to support the board's reasoning to deny the permit. Your Honor, did you have a...
Well, I mean, I just was sitting here wondering if we have enough for meaningful review. You obviously think we do.
I do, Your Honor, because when you look at what all was presented by the remonstrators in this case regarding the aesthetics of the aesthetic impact and the visual impact that this tower would have, and going to the comment made earlier regarding the not in my backyard, this was not a situation where you had generalized concerns of aesthetics. These people came with specific photographs showing specifically taking photos taken from the balloon test. The balloon test was a test run by Cincinnati Bell Wireless that is specifically done to determine the visual impact of a tower. It shows you where the top of the tower is. When you do this, they extrapolated, Ms. Cody extrapolated a 190-foot tower based on the same dimensions, an 18.5-foot wide at the bottom, 5 feet at the top, and extrapolated that into these pictures and superimposed into these pictures. And we are dealing with a situation where this tower is going to be in their backyards. They're going to see it from every angle. And it's not just the people in this one street. There are people from other streets dealing with it. And this is a very pristine, natural. I've been there myself. I know what it looks like, and I'm not testifying on behalf of the remonstrators, but this is a pristine area that was
They said so, too, I think. So.
Yes, so, and a natural area that certainly this would stick out in.
You make it sound like the Eiffel Tower. Mm-hmm. Just think of what people pay to have a view of that.
The structure is not harmonious with or appropriate in appearance with the existing or intended character of the surrounding area, and therefore the board.
Is there ever a tower, agriculture or otherwise, as far as the area is concerned,
well,
that enhances the visual appearance of the area?
Well, I can understand the court's concern, but in this situation, Dearborn County has established seven different areas where it is more appropriate to have a tower than this one. So,
how big is this county?
Oh, I'm not sure of the exact land area. It is the county that is right next to Cincinnati. It is a commuter county primarily.
Well, the reason I ask is if they, and I will ask Mr. McTeer, if the county's of a size that it's not too large as far as land mass, square mileage, it would seem to me that a tower could be anywhere, one of the other seven locations, but perhaps Cincinnati Bell feels that it won't serve us completely.
Your Honor, I would also, with regard to the final two claims, the effective prohibition and the unreasonable discrimination, first with unreasonable discrimination, the key is unreasonable. If there is a reason for the denial that is supported by substantial evidence, it's not unreasonable. The House report said that it provides this specific section provides localities with the flexibility to treat facilities that create different visual, aesthetic, or safety concerns differently to the extent permitted under generally applicable zoning requirements.
So this is a board of four. Does it have a larger board, or is it just somebody who didn't participate? I mean,
it's a board of five. The chair does not vote unless there's a tie.
I see.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Lowe. Mr. McTeer? Can you just satisfy inquiry about the county, other suggested locations as to your capacity to service the consumers you wish to?
Your Honor, I think as was noted by Judge Robner, in this case, the search ring was all agricultural. So to provide the service we needed, it had to be in the agricultural area. Now, Mr. Lowe says, well, that's Cincinnati Bell Wireless's search ring. That was submitted to the expert. That was reviewed by the expert. The expert, hired by the board, agreed with us that it needed to be within that search ring to provide the service we needed.
And none of the other suggested sites that would satisfy your capacity? Or?
Particular, there were, I think, three specific existing facilities that the maps, most of the information goes to the existing facilities, but the maps can show, I mean, I don't need to have a map of a tower on top of this building to know that I'm not going to provide service to the area I need to serve. So the consultants would know the general parameters for where this tower would have to be. And, Your Honor, I think you accurately said, as we state in our brief, this is the NIMBY. This is not in my backyard. I mean, under the search ring issue is a perfect example. They say it's our search ring. That was approved and reviewed by their expert. Their expert agreed that this was the least visually intrusive application they can. The substantial evidence in this case, really when it boils down to it, is the photo simulations taken by the Codys, who are the neighboring landowner. If this court is going to hold
that... But they did base that, though, on your balloon test, right? The balloon shows where the top of the tower is going to be?
Correct.
So I'm not sure why that... I mean, I know it's photoshopped or whatever, however they did it, but why is that so dubious in your view?
Well, one, as I think I said earlier, and I think it's mentioned in our brief, it was a little unclear to me the exact tower that was superimposed.
But does it matter? Did you think the simulation made it too high? Or
I thought it made it look too much in the foreground, because there were instances in some of the photographs where the tree is here, but at least one leg of the tower is in front of the tree. But let's accept that, okay, so there is a picture in the record that shows the facility. So is that going to be substantial evidence every time we have a facility that somebody goes and does a photo simulation? Therefore, they can see the facility. Therefore, it's substantial evidence to allow a board or agency to deny the application.
Well, the question is it evidence on the question of visual impact? Surely it is.
And
evidence
I would,
about
I,
that. Visual impact isn't the only factor.
Correct. I would agree that it is at least some evidence of the visual impact of the facility. But
and isn't that one of the criteria then under the Dearborn County Ordinance?
Yes, and in fact that's one of the criteria under Article 15. And in fact the experts said that we had satisfied that we had presented a sufficient visual impact study, and that in fact this was the least visually intrusive application that they can. Now, Your Honor has said, well, doesn't that just mean as to this piece of property? I don't think it's that narrow. I think that was their testimony that this was the least visually intrusive application of anything within the search ring. I mean, to your point, Your Honor, if we move it across the street, there's going to be some other set of neighbors that are going to be equally unhappy that we've now moved it away. We have to have it in an area that will provide coverage. I understand Dearborn County would like us to move it out of the county, but that does us no good to meet the needs of the search ring to provide service to our customers in the area. And I can assure you we would not be building this tower if we didn't and go through the process we've already gone through of now over 4 years if we didn't feel like there was a need to serve our customers and that this wasn't the best location as determined by the board's experts. I mean, it seems to allow them, the board, to use this essentially aesthetics as a visual, as an Article 3 fiat, means that no matter what we do with the board's experts, we're never going to get through the process.
Well, thank you, sir. Did you have a concluding remark?
Well, actually, just as I was thinking over there, I was just my concluding remark is just to go back to where we started, that we would ask this court to reverse the district court with instructions for it to remand the matter to the board to issue the conditional use permit to Cincinnati Bell Wireless. But before I leave, I just wanted to, some better direction. Should, on the jurisdictional issue, if we can resolve it to dismiss the claims with prejudice, would an agreed order to this court?
Well, if you would submit a joint
stipulation
statement
to this court that says we're willing,
and you would need to brief anything.
That would probably be my clients. They'll probably be willing to do that.
Well, we'll await.
But I need to obviously speak to them.
Surely. That's why I set it at 14 days. Is that an oppressive time schedule for you?
I think not. I mean, if that's I think the issue will be resolved as we suggested by a joint stipulation.
But Mr. Lowe, you're comfortable with that time frame, I assume. All right.
Hopefully, that'll be one of my first tasks when I talk to the client after leaving this hearing today. We have another item of discussion.
Thank both counsel. Safe trip home.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Your Honors.
Taken under advisement.